So welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us on our policy deep dive into New York's implementation of congestion pricing. My name is Caroline Spivak. I'm a reporter, covers transportation and climate for a publication called Crane's New York Business. We cover New York for the city's business community. So before I introduce our wonderful panel, I'm going to set the stage for us a bit about what we're going to be talking about. So what is congestion pricing? If you're not familiar with the topic, at its core, congestion pricing is a fee charged to motorists for driving on busy city roads to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and improve air quality, while also generating funding to improve and promote the use of mass transit. So urban cores in London, Stockholm, Singapore, and elsewhere have adopted congestion pricing. And in New York City, the congestion pricing program is officially called the Central Business District Tolling Program, and it would be the first city in the U.S. to embrace congestion pricing. So we get at least 2 decades of discourse and debate on congestion pricing in New York, and it was finally in 2019 when the New York State Legislature passed legislation that would advance and enact congestion pricing. So fast forward to now, after delays and a lengthy environmental review process for congestion pricing, it's expected to take effect for essentially the lower half of Manhattan, so anything below 60th Street, in mid-June is the expected start date. So pretty soon. And at the end of March, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the MTA, which runs the city's mass transit, voted to approve a toll structure for congestion pricing. We can get into the specifics later in our conversation, but most drivers will be charged a daytime toll of $15 to enter Manhattan below 60th Street. Trucks, depending on their size, will be charged between $24 and $36. So crucially for the MTA and New York Transit, congestion pricing is expected to raise $1 billion revenue annually, which the MTA plans to bond to $15 billion to upgrade the city's subway, buses, and commuter rail. So there's a lot to unpack here. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce our speakers. So to my left, we have Betsy Plum, the Executive Director of the Riders Alliance, New York's grassroots organization of bus and subway riders, advocating for improved sustainable transit. And then we have Juliet Michelson, the Deputy Chief External Relations Officer at the MTA. Juliet served as the Executive Director on the body that recommended the specific tolls to the MTA's board, the Traffic Mobility Review Board. And then we have Mary Barber, a climate and transit consultant based in New Jersey, in Barber's most recent role as state director for New York and New Jersey at the Environmental Defense Fund, she advocated for science-based climate policies, including congestion pricing. Just to kick off our conversation, I think it's just important to note how uniquely vast the scale of transit is in New York City. Just a few stats that I want to share. New York City has 472 subway stations, 331 local, select, and express bus routes. On the average weekday, well over 3 million people ride the subway, more than 1 million people ride city buses, and over 400,000 people ride the commuter rail networks, which is Long Island Railroad and Metro North. So with those numbers in mind, let's take a few minutes to talk through the significance of transit in the city and why investing in it is so crucial for both getting riders around and the climate. Juliet, would you want to start us off?
By a show of hands, how many people have lived in New York? Okay, so like half. And I assume others have seen the city. I mean, you know, it's hard to, it really is a city unlike any other American city. We like to say, well, the MTA carries about 40% of all transit trips every day that are taken in the whole entire country. The 4, 5, and 6 line carry as many people as the entire Washington, D.C. metro system. The scale is just, you know, on another level. And that means that it is not that it is an entire urban area, an entire sort of social construct that is an economic structures that are built around transit, right? So when we think about the subways or buses or commuter rail, it's not just sort of an additional way to get around. For most people, it is the only way to get around. The many, many New Yorkers, what share of New Yorkers don't own a car? You know, off the top of your head?
Most
New Yorkers don't own a car.
Highly scientific.
I should know this. 85% of people who commute into Manhattan take transit, 11% drive. So that is, you know, just sort of to set the stage in terms of like what this system, what the kind of urban structure is needed to even consider something like congestion pricing, or certainly at the scale that we're considering it. The area that you described is pretty big, all the way up to 60th Street. And it really is sort of central to the entire region.
Yeah. You know, so as I said, it's taken us many years to get to this point of implementing congestion pricing in the city. What's led up to this moment? What was, in your view, what was the catalyst for congestion pricing?
I think you're the best.
Well, I'll just note by saying a little bit like on what we do, we organize riders. And I think for many, many years, riders were not organized. And that's an important piece to, I think, a longer origin story of congestion pricing. But the MTA is a huge, huge, huge agency and authority, right? It has a budget bigger than some countries. And unfortunately, for years, suffered from neglect, you know, the robbing of funds from it, mismanagement. And that deteriorated a system that requires billions and billions of dollars of investment on a good day. Now we're very happy with the hands of the MTA, so now I want to say that. But it wasn't always that way. And that got us to a place where riders were really suffering. And if you're not up in Albany in our state capital demanding that riders have a voice, riders are sort of the most easily ignored population. And so that got us to the mid-aughts. Is that what the 2010s are called? I think something like that.
Teens.
In the summer of hell, right, where subway delays had quadrupled. There were massive, you know, multiple derailments. Andrew Cuomo came out and, you know, the governor at the time and didn't say, oh, it's all going to be okay. He was like, yeah, it sucks. And you should get ready for it to be worse. And that was the moment, you know, when congestion pricing, this policy that had been in the air for decades, finally had a political reality that made it possible. And I think having an organized base of riders that were able to say, we need this policy for all of the environmental reasons that have been pushed, all of the traffic mitigation reasons that have been discussed and pushed for decades, but also we need it to actually fix the subway, because as Juliette said, that's how we all travel and get around. And so that was the turning point. And by 2019, there had been enough political will built. We still had a governor that was willing to stand behind it. There were lots of strange bedfellows, right? The cast of organizations that came out in support of congestion pricing was, you know, groups that wouldn't sit in this room together, but both came and supported the policy, I think just shows not only how popular it was across economic, environmental, and social justice spaces, but just how common sense it is for New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, thinking about the climate impacts, you know, how does congestion pricing factor into the city and the state's achieving city and state's climate targets to deeply reduce greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, thanks. It's critical. And so just to step back for a second, one thing that's important to know is New York, I believe it's still at this point, it has the lowest emissions, greenhouse gas emissions per capita of any state in the country. And a lot of that is because it's for a lot of reasons, but a lot of that is because downstate is a huge population center in the city and because of the transit system, and that the whole city and region really thrives. Like Juliet said, the economic structure that this transit system sort of upholds, I would add to that the environmental and sustainability structure that that transit system upholds. The city will not, in addition to just reducing emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, which transportation is a huge percentage of that in the state, as well as tailpipe emissions, right? Those will go down. Those are really the health impacting emissions that our communities, especially our overburdened disadvantaged communities, suffer from the most. In addition to that, though, just thinking about sustainability, we will drown in cars and trucks if we don't somehow shift the balance. And that is a quality of life. It's environmental. It's safety. It's just all wrapped up in making sure that this incredible system is also sustained, maintained, and thrives on its own economically, environmentally, sustainably.
Yeah, and I just want to take a minute to unpack, you know, when we say improvements to transit, we're talking about, you know, electrifying the bus, modernizing signals, making subway stations ADA accessible, generally improving the state of transit infrastructure. And so these are projects that, of course, take time. They're not going to happen overnight. So what, in the short term and the longer term, are the expected benefits of congestion pricing? Mary just talked through some of the environmental ones, but generally speaking, what can New Yorkers expect?
I think of them in two buckets. The first are going to be the benefits that we see literally on day one. And how often does it happen that you get to implement a policy that has an effect right away? On day one, we're expecting 15 to 20% fewer vehicles to enter the CBD, what we have started calling the CBD. Nobody used to call the CBD the whole, but anyway, what we will be calling the congestion relief zone. So way, way, way fewer vehicles entering, presumably starting on day one. Cleaner air, faster buses, faster paratransit vehicles, and frankly, even for deliveries or taxis, FHVs, first responders, businesses, you know, who have to drive around, they will have a much more reliable way to travel. So that's sort of the first bucket of benefits. And then the second bucket of benefits is what you were alluding to, which is the transit construction projects that congestion pricing is expected to, will be funding. So in 2019, the MTA developed its five-year capital plan that was supposed to cover from 2020 to 2024. It was the largest capital program ever, made very large in part in response to what Riders Alliance and others had pushed for, you know, reminding the governor that this was his responsibility to fix transit in New York. I think a lot of people had been under the impression that it was a mayor's responsibility, but it is in fact a state agency. So instead of what had been like a $33 billion capital program every 5 years, this one was $55 billion. So a huge, huge increase. And a large part of that increase was on the promise that this congestion pricing program was going to come into effect, raising $15 billion for projects. The significance of the 20 to 24 program, in addition to just its size, was that it included a huge commitment, 70 stations to be made ADA accessible. And that is it's long overdue, no question, but totally transformative. We've gotten most of the way through. We have about 25 or so stations left to build. Those would be the ones, or to award, I should say. The program also included modern signals on a lot of train lines that allow for trains to run closer together and just sort of generally more reliable train service. It also included the electrification of the bus fleet and a lot of other, you know, just electrification of bus depots, a lot of other really good projects. And it also included all the things that Betsy talked about, which is like fixing the rails and making sure that, you know, just that like the, what we call state of good repair, all the infrastructure is properly maintained so that trains don't get delayed, stuck, derailed, et cetera.
Yeah. And I do want us to touch on some concerns that have been raised about congestion pricing, but briefly before we get to that, Julia, I was hoping you could kind of, you know, lay the ground or set the stage for us rather on, you know, what was the review process? What did that entail? What was the public engagement process for congestion pricing?
Okay, so how much time do we have?
Yeah.
So I'm speaking to a lot of environmental reporters, so this actually might be like the crowd who knows the difference between an EA and an EIS. Okay, I love it. So the law was passed in April 2019. This was still the Trump administration. They were not too keen to be helping New York, so they kind of sat on the decision of whether the project needed to go through an EA or an EIS. When the Biden administration started, one of the first, within the first few months, they set us on a path toward an environmental assessment. So that kicked off in the spring of 2021. And that launched an incredibly elaborate traffic modeling analytics exercise that resulted in 4,000-page environmental assessments. That process also included a huge amount of public engagement. I don't have the statistics off the top of my head, but it was. But I know we ended up with 77,000 comments that we received and responded to. But we also held, you know, dozens and dozens of public meetings and public hearings, and we would meet with literally anybody who asked. We would meet with. It was on that basis that the federal government gave us a FONSI in June of 2023. And the sort of odd thing about this process is that the EA had not studied just one toll structure. It studied seven different toll structures, seven different ways that you could charge more some drivers and less other drivers. You could provide credits in this way or that way. You could discount these types of vehicles and not those types. And so the FONSI that we received was on the basis of generally these all seven of these scenarios are acceptable. They are not causing undue environmental impact. And so as long as the final toll structure that you choose is within the those guidelines, within the, if they're similar to the seven scenarios, you'll be fine. So after we received the FONSI, that's when we started a whole separate process to determine what the final toll structure should be. That took place in the summer and the fall. As you said, the MTA just finally approved that toll structure. So we are now going back to FHWA and saying, okay, this is the final toll structure. This is the traffic impacts on environmental justice communities and other places. Here's how it's in line with the FONSI that you gave us, which it is, of course. And so we expect to receive the final green light from them in the form of a VPPP in the next few weeks. So that's the process that we've been through.
Thank you for talking us through that. Okay, so within the environmental assessment, it acknowledged that certain areas, such as environmental justice communities in the Bronx, could see a rise in traffic, emphasis on could, and air pollution as a result of motorists taking routes to avoid the tolls. So, you know, perhaps this is a question for Betsy and Mary, but, you know, in your conversations with folks and communities, and what are you hearing about the concerns there? There's been mitigation measures that, you know, are set to take effect, you know, that are going to be invested in, I should say. Is that a concern? Is that a major concern moving forward with congestion pricing?
Do you want to start with
that? So it is a concern. I mean, yeah, absolutely. None of us, and I'm one of those that's been advocating for this since 2007 when it was proposed by then Mayor Bloomberg's administration. It absolutely is a concern. We don't want to see any unintended consequences of more air pollution in especially those communities that already experience environmental injustice. So the MTA, that part of the process was forming an environmental justice working group with organizations across New York City, and I believe even some New Jersey groups were invited into that. So there is that, and that stays in place now as it moves forward. And there are mitigation measures, that's, and you probably all know this, that mitigation measures have to be, if impacts are found, then the project sponsor has to propose mitigation measures. And so they did that immediately. Some folks felt not robust enough, so had to come back with more. And so they are in place, and we can go through, all of us can probably list some of them, including like in the Bronx at Hunts Point, the huge market, to clean up 1,000 of the TRUs. Those are those refrigerated trucks that they use to store food that are, they just are just pollutants. That's what they are. So they're going to clean up 1,000 of those. So things like that. But I want to add to this that for folks like Betsy and me and the other advocates, it's going to be our job to continue as this switches on to ensure that the MTA and it's really whole of government, right? There are multiple state agencies involved and city to ensure that those mitigation measures are in place, that they're working. And if there are any unintended consequences outside of what's been addressed, that those get addressed. So I'll leave it there.
I would just add, seconding everything Mary said, but also one of the conversations that we've had a lot within our advocate coalition is congestion pricing is not the problem in these communities, right? It's the fact that these communities are environmental justice communities and will potentially see an uptick in traffic because decades ago we ripped through them with highways, and that's where the highways are. And so, you know, the MTA didn't build the Cross Bronx Expressway or the Staten Island Expressway. And so understanding congestion pricing as part of the sea change that will allow for a healthier future, investing in transit, but also being able to couple investments, not just in what the MTA can do alone, right? Because the MTA can't, you know, cap the Cross Bronx Expressway despite that $18 billion budget. And so, you know, when Mary says the whole of government, that's what we're navigating here, is how other agencies that are in many ways far more a part of the problem are able to tie to congestion pricing the types of investments and future that will allow congestion pricing to be as wonderfully impactful without a negative consequence. And I think seeing our governor really take that moment and say, okay, I'm going to direct other agencies that I oversee to work in concert under the banner of congestion pricing to, for example, begin cleaning up the Hunts Point market and making that air cleaner is really key. And it's what has kept, a lot of the environmental justice community led organizations that were so critical to advancing congestion pricing has kept them at the table. The other thing I want to just note, though, is we have had to do a lot to distinguish the legitimate concern from like sort of the concern created by the evening news and then how that sort of plays telephone in communities. And we see this with our membership, which, you know, for the most part are low income communities of color in the outer boroughs living in environmental justice communities. You know, they read something, they hear something, and they're worried about congestion pricing. And so we have to be able to both tell the totality of the story and what this means. We have to be able to couple it with what is actually happening at their stations, because, you know, these are communities that have been left abandoned in some cases by a transit system, and now this is the reinvestment. But there's been a lot of fact and there's also been a lot of myth. And that's a tricky navigating point because you really do want to legitimize the legitimate concern and you want to myth bust the less legitimate concerns.
Go ahead.
It's almost so obvious, but I think I still feel like we need to say it out loud that people who take transit, who will benefit from these transit investments, are by and large much lower income than the people who are driving into the city. So, you know, yeah, I'll just leave it there.
Yeah. So I just want to play devil's advocate here for a moment. So say I'm someone who's living in the outer boroughs, you know, way out in Queens, and I say, hey, you know, I need my car to get into the city. I don't have convenient access to a subway station. It takes me a long time. I have to take a couple of buses to get to the train. It's just too much of a headache. I have equipment that I have to take in from my business. Car is more convenient for me. What would you say to someone who's making that argument that they need their car?
Yes, because we do a lot of these conversations. I'll start. First, to Juliet's point, let's say there's a legitimate person that really needs their car. Oftentimes, that person is making enough that the $15 toll, then with, you know, the toll credits applied to it, which could bring it down to $10 if they're driving in at like the most peak of peak times, which a lot of these, you know, if this is a legitimate case, these folks are driving in at off peak hours, that, you know, what might be $3 to $5 would be worth it because the traffic will be less. You'll be able to do, you know, it sounds like this could be like a construction worker. Maybe they'll be able to get to more sites. We talk about the plumber. This is good for drivers too, right? This is good for the average worker. But the thing that we have to say far, far more often is those folks are the exception, right? If we talk about a low income individual in the outer borough, 49 of those individuals are on transit. One of those individuals is in a car. And so if we're really talking about the people that most need our investment, our time, our care, our reporting, we don't hear the stories, right, about the nurse who takes 3 buses to get to a train and then, you know, is stuck because we have years and years of deferred maintenance, right? Like, those are the types of stories we need to be hearing, but it is much easier to tell the story of the aggrieved individual who will never be able to drive into Manhattan again, rather than the vast majority of individuals who are like our membership and just suffer from some of the most excruciating commutes and deserve to finally have a transit system that they can rely on.
I don't think I can add to that, really.
So I sat through about 19 hours of public comment about a month ago. And, it is hard. Like, you do hear those stories. You hear about people who have built a life in what is undeniably a very expensive city. And here we are changing the rules on them. It is hard. Like, I am very sympathetic. The problem is that, as Betsy just said, they are the exception. And what we're creating here is a program that is, you know, sort of transformative at a societal level. And inevitably, some people are going to get caught in awkward positions. And, there are lots of things that the MTA has done to try to help folks like that. So if people have to travel at night when transit options really are more limited, the toll is much, much lower. It's only $3.75. For people who are very low income, we did cut the toll rate in half. You can get a low income credit for low income folks who live in the zone. There's a tax credit on top of that. People who are disabled in some way or who care for somebody who's disabled can get an exemption. So, you know, there are some things that we can do, but there are also individual stories. We just have to remember that at the societal scale, this is definitely the more environmentally responsible and so and like equity responsible way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So congestion pricing, it's worth noting, has had multiple lawsuits filed against it, and it's coming down to the wire. You know, congestion pricing, like I said, we said earlier, the expectation is mid-June. There was a court case in federal New Jersey court that was arguments were heard earlier this week. That case is may not be decided until early June, and that is widely considered one of the more serious challenges that congestion pricing is facing. I was actually in court with Mary, and I was curious, Mary, you could kind of talk through, you know, your thoughts on hearing those arguments and if you felt they hold water, just very briefly. Basically, New Jersey has brought a case against congestion pricing, saying that, you know, one of the core arguments is that there is a concern that, you know, because motorists, truck drivers will be taking winding routes around Manhattan, that communities in New Jersey will be unduly burdened. That is one of the arguments.
Yeah, so I should start with a couple things. I'm not a lawyer. And there were two full days of these court hearings before the judge, and I was just there for the last afternoon. But what I found fascinating was, as someone who's been so deeply involved in this, and you all know, the whole regulatory process, EA, EIS, it's complex. It's, you know, if you're not living it every day, I know as advocates, we were constantly, okay, is this next? And being in court on Thursday, the judge was terrific at really getting the lawyers to be very clear. DOJ was there representing the FHWA, the MTA had their lawyers, and of course, Randy Mastro and his firm are representing New Jersey. And I thought the judge did a great job of really getting everybody clear on what the regs are, what the MTA, the project sponsor, the FHWA in their role had to do as part of the NEPA process. That's what this is all about. And I thought it was made very clear. And I left acknowledging I'm an advocate, a longtime advocate, wanting to see congestion pricing start. I felt after those few hours that the project sponsor and the FHWA made a really good case for why the EA was acceptable, all 4,000 pages of it, and that it followed the regs, and that New Jersey had many, many opportunities to make their case for their concerns as part of the process, and they didn't. That was the case. I don't know, Caroline, you did I capture that?
You got it. So, you know, just moving on, because I want to make sure that we're able to touch on some other important points before we move to audience Q&A. I wanted us to touch on, you know, how the Traffic Mobility Review Board arrived at the final tolling structure. Again, I know that's a massive topic, but, you know, when it comes to thinking about, you know, exemptions and who gets discounts, I mean, everyone was weighing in, saying, making their case. Julia, can you talk us through what the thinking was in terms of determining who needed to be exempt?
So let me first start by saying there were few different goals. I mean, the toll structure had to be within the bounds of the EA, number one. Number two, it had to raise $1 billion. And number three, it had to reduce traffic congestion, like the number of vehicles entering the CBD by at least 10%. So those were sort of the broad, and then there were a few exemptions that were already written into the law, which were emergency vehicles and vehicles carrying people with disabilities. Not exactly an exemption, but another type of trip in the CBD that won't be charged are trips that stay exclusively on the highway, the peripheral highways, which actually ends up being a lot of the trips in below 16th Street, interestingly. So in any case, the toll structure had to follow all of those things, and the $1 billion a year is a shorthand way to calculate how much needs to be raised to raise $15 billion, which is technically the legislative requirement. And so if you think about it, the sort of evil genius that Cuomo's legislation put us in is that, you know, the law essentially is saying, okay, well, you can figure out who's going to pay what, but the more exemptions you give to some drivers, the more other drivers are going to have to pay, because you got to be raising more or less $1 billion a year. And that was, in a way, really, hard, because we did end up with a $15 a day toll, which is not nothing. You know, I think we had all been hoping that we could end up with a little less than that. But what it did do was it made it much easier. As Caroline said, we received requests for exemptions from everybody. I mean, farmers, musicians, people who have medical appointments, people who live in the CBD, people who don't live in the CBD but need to come into the CBD. I mean, like, everybody. And so it was, in a sense, a lot easier to say nobody gets an exemption except for, I mean, literally the only exemptions that we granted in addition to what I just talked about were transit buses, specialized government vehicles, like, you know, public works vehicle that are required to travel into the CBD. That's it. And so it just makes it easier when somebody says, well, I don't have good transit options, so, you know, I need an exemption. Or, you know, it just makes it easier to say no when you've said no to everybody. Once you open the door, it's a slippery slope. Oh, so cabs, this was a really interesting outcome, actually, because the EA, the EA originally had directed us to charge them just like any other vehicle, which seems so incredibly unfair, because number one, it's not the cab driver, the cab driver would have had to pay it, right? And it's not the cab driver's choice to enter the zone or not. It's the rider. And number two, what if the vehicle only made one trip that day? They don't, cabbies and FHV drivers don't choose which, they'd have to take the trips that they're assigned. So we negotiated, it was a long negotiation with our federal friends. But what we ended up doing was splitting the daily toll into a per ride toll. So we looked at the data, trip data today. An Uber or a Lyft typically does 6 trips in the CBD, in the zone, every day. So we took $15, we divided by 6 and ended up with a charge of $250. And yellow taxis typically make 12 trips a day in the zone, so they ended up with $1.25. Kind of worked out nicely. It's sort of half the amount. There were lots of taxi drivers, taxi medallion owners who requested an exemption entirely because their industry as a whole is suffering. Uber and Lyft, probably in lots of cities, have really taken over the lion's share of tips. At the end of the day, I think, you know, that it is a, it is, it, they, it, it, I am sympathetic. It is true that they have been suffering. At the same time, this is a congestion charge. They are a large, you know, taxis and FHVs together are about half of all vehicles in the zone. They are a major contributor, I guess, to transit, so to traffic. So charging them sort of half of what FHVs get charged seemed like a fair outcome.
Yeah. So once congestion pricing is live, there's going to be opportunity to adjust it in real time. That's maybe you can start us off. What's kind of the beauty of that? You know, what's the room for opportunity in ensuring that congestion pricing is able to work for as many people as possible?
I think this the beauty of it is sort of what has also made the environmental review process so complicated. It's not like we're building a bridge, right, which would have a clear environmental review process. And then the bridge is like where it is. You might decide that, oh, we really should have put that bridge like a half mile down the river. Like, you can't do that. Congestion pricing, you can, you know, and Juliet can speak to the logistics and the mechanics of how this all happens, but it is a very, very adaptable and flexible type of policy that will allow us to see what actually happens, right? We've seen these different sort of worst case scenarios that, you know, that's how I'd like to understand them, that developed the recommendations that the TMRB made, but we'll actually see what happens. You know, one of the very wonky advocate debates actually has to get to the traffic modeling. And, you know, the MTA used one model and all of the traffic experts actually say there's this other model that's potentially a different look at what would actually happen. And they tell you two different things, you know, both tell you something good, which is that people will drive less. We'll actually see what happens. We'll see how many people go to transit. We'll see how many people continue to drive. You know, we'll see how many drivers actually are not doomed to never be able to drive into Manhattan again, but do actually choose to continue driving in. And that'll be a really wonderful element of this policy. I think what we're watching as a rider advocate group is what happens with buses. You know, are we able to speed up some buses? Are we able to see more service? Are we able to use this as an opportunity to push our mayor to do, you know, more of what he can, because he controls the streets, you know, and giving buses priority? And we'll be able to push the MTA to move very quickly on the rider improvements that we so desperately need to see, and which is why riders have been really robust advocates for this program.
A couple things. In other cities, and you all may know this, what we've seen is in the beginning, people hated it. Like Juliet, you know, who wants to pay more? Didn't I say that? Oh, in the beginning. Yes, before it starts. Sorry.
In the beginning.
Before the program starts, there's lots of upheaval and people hate it. And then any new thing, there will probably be some rocky days in the beginning. But then in all of these places, generally over time, the public becomes very supportive because they see the improvements. They start to recognize the improvements. So that's one thing. And then secondly, just to put a final point on it, the MTA, and it's in the EA, has committed to adaptive management, right? That they are going to, through all of this monitoring that they're doing, both traffic, environment, all the different pieces, they are going to continue to monitor that, and they will adapt to what happens. So if there's a problem, they will adapt to getting to Betsy's point.
And all the data is not, we have open data. All the monitoring.
Yeah, I mean,
just a quick clarifier. I'm sorry. Do you mean in the European city where this has happened that they?
Yes.
Okay.
London, Stockholm. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and what would be the mechanics of that, Juliet, in terms of the you know, making changes? Like, will there be like a process for people to engage once a change has been decided? Like, how will that work?
Too soon. I mean, to be perfectly frank with you, it is not totally clear.
Well, but I can say from your EA at least, it's not totally clear. But again, the Environmental Justice Working Group is established and will remain there to meet quarterly. So that is definitely an opportunity. And if you look at the EA, they're currently, the MTA and other state and city, because it's a joint thing, right? Like city DOT, they are getting baselines right now. So there's work underway in preparation. So even though the process, like the public process or whatever, for these changes that might have to occur isn't totally nailed down, it's in process to get to that point.
Yeah. So last question, and we'll move into Q&A. So in thinking about congestion pricing and New York as a model for other cities in the U.S., it's worth noting that San Francisco has indefinitely paused a study of downtown congestion pricing, Officials near San Diego voted this past year to drop a proposal for a road user charge. And Los Angeles is studying congestion pricing for several zones, but transportation planners haven't settled on a specific proposal yet. Other cities are having beginning talks. So considering that in some cities we're seeing a bit of a standstill right now, how important do you view successful implementation of congestion pricing in New York as, you know, spurring other cities to act on congestion pricing? Or is New York uniquely positioned to benefit from congestion pricing?
Just to go back to the first thing I said, New York is like no other city. There's no other city that will in America, I don't think, in the near future, that would implement something at this scale. But like, I could absolutely see a much smaller area like downtown Boston, or even like resort towns. I mean, small downtowns that try to be pedestrian, bike friendly in the summer. I could completely imagine, with this tolling infrastructure, that's, you don't have to stop, you don't have to exchange cash or credit card. It's just on the easy pass. Nobody even notices probably that they're all being charged. There are lots of, I think that it might be a while until another city does something at this scale, but little bits of congestion management through pricing, absolutely.
No, I think it matters a lot, even though I agree New York is New York and it won't be the same anywhere, but everybody's watching,
mm-hmm.
right? And I think there would be, what the MTA has done with the EA, there will be incredible learnings for everyone that will come out of this that will be so important.
Right. Well, so with that, I think we're going to move to audience Q&A. Just as a reminder, SEJ members and journalists first for questions. Please identify yourself and your affiliation. And reminder, brevity is the soul of wit, so try and keep it concise.
Sure. Michael Warren with NJ Spotlight News. I want to ask a question about an agency whose name was not spoken, and that's NJ Transit. Look at Governor Murphy's statements and Representative Gottheimer's statements and all the other officials that have been loud and angry about this. It all comes down to they feel like NJ Transit should get a cut. And arguably, there's some logic there, right? That if less people are driving in from New Jersey, they're going to have to come in either on an NJ Transit bus or an NJ Transit train. Was there ever a consideration to sending funding to new NJ Transit? Is it something that could be on the table at maybe a lawsuit settlement? Does New York law even allow the MTA to send money to NJ Transit?
I don't know that it's been a serious consideration. I also don't know that New Jersey was really deeply involved in the development of the program 3 years ago when those types of decisions could have been made.
I'll jump in because I think because there is a lawsuit, right? Sorry, underway. And I, after living in New York for many years, I now live in New Jersey. So I'm a New Jerseyan who supports congestion pricing. And I think, you've heard all the arguments, right? Okay, lots of places are told, the turnpike's told, whatever. Are we going to turn around and say, that money that New Jersey gets from those tolls, a piece of that should go to New Yorkers and Pennsylvanians who are always on the turnpike? There's those arguments. And then I would also say, it's just so political. I will just say that. And riders and environmental, there's been a big movement in New Jersey, right, to get some investment in NJ Transit as an NJ Transit rider. It's not good. And the governor in this budget has done something, which is great. But that's sort of an imbalance with New Jersey trying to put all this focus on New York that's trying to really solve a problem, lots of problems. And what could maybe be also happening in New Jersey to solve similar problems.
I agree.
Woman in the pink shirt.
I'm Mary Landers. I live in Savannah, Georgia, and work for The Current.
which we cover coastal Georgia. For those of us who are not familiar at all with Manhattan, can you just describe what this looks like physically? Like, and, you know, how many entrance points are there, exit points? Like, what happens?
So the second, I mean, so it's a, it's an island. So there are maybe a dozen or so avenues that run into the zone from the north, and then there are seven, I think, bridges and tunnels that enter from the west and the east and the south. So those are relatively easy. And then, you know, up on the north side, there are mast arms that are, that have cameras on them and easy pass readers.
They look like street light poles.
They're pretty, and a lot of times, yeah, the, a lot of times the cameras are actually installed on street light poles. So we try to make it as invisible as possible.
It's like a couple dozen entry points.
Yeah, there are about 100 mast arms. There are 100 detection points altogether.
And you don't have to buy an easy pass. You'll just get billed if you
If you don't have an easy pass, you'll get charged by mail, but there's a pretty steep surcharge for that. You'll pay about 50% more.
And I'll catch you. Those bills will
fine. You have an easy pass. Yes.
Next question, the woman in the back.
Hi, I'm LB Anderson with Brits. Aaron Gordon at Vice wrote this pretty provocative article about 6 months ago or last fall, basically saying that New York is screwing up congestion pricing. He made the argument that, you know, the law basically prioritizes revenue over all other possible co-benefits, said that because, you know, the revenue has to be used for capital projects, riders are not going to see the benefit, you know, riders and pedestrians and cyclists. They're not going to see the benefit right away. The streets are going to feel the same. Obviously, the revenue can't even be used for, like, pedestrian and cycling infrastructure because that's the DOT. So, and also that it was going to, like, lock the MTA into, like, this cycle of debt where, like, they're borrowing to pay for these, like, you know, big capital projects that are overpriced, like the Second Avenue subway. So, obviously very provocative, and I just wanted to hear your response, especially Juliette, but I'd be interested in that, too.
That's for me. I could answer this in so many ways. Look, so I don't think it's fair to say that there will not be benefits on the street. Clearly, congestion will go down. Clearly, buses will move faster, vehicles, etc. What the city then decides to do with the additional street space, you know, that will give them greater flexibility. You know, the capital program, the MTA, has had a history, as Betsy pointed out earlier, of, you know, not always being the most well-managed agency. But I would say that for the last, you know, that has really, really changed the last 5-10 years. People always like to talk about the Second Avenue subway, but there have been lots of projects since then that are that have been delivered on time and under budget, the L train, the third track. We just completed the track clarification of an entire stretch of the F line. The whole, the large stretch was closed for 7 months. We reopened it on time. The project was done under budget. Elevators, et cetera, all around the system are being built on time and on budget. So I, you know, and look, I heard at these public hearings, I heard from a lot of people who rely on those elevators, who are fighting really hard for this to move forward. There really are very tangible benefits to the system.
I just want to chime in with a lot of respect for Aaron's piece, but this has to be part of a rising tide, right? Congestion pricing can't solve all the issues. I think you, the rising tide we like. the piece that I think is critical here is something you noted, right? Which is it isn't just the MTA, it's DOT, it's the state, it's the city. It's really is this chess game when we talk about the benefits of congestion pricing. And as rider advocates, we're really disappointed in the fact that the city and that the mayor has not made more of the opportunity that we have here to get out ahead of this and to say, you want to know what? I'm going to put busways and bus lanes on a number of, you know, feeder routes and then within the zone. And so I think that's why there is a hope as this rolls out that more of that will be done. But I think that's a really important piece. And then I think the service element is a critical one. You know, we love to talk about the need for service and, you know, the operating investment, but the governor last year in New York made one of the largest service investments in subways that's been made, you know, in recent history. And right now in our, you know, hopefully we'll have a state budget soon, but there's a request to have a budget for more bus service on the places where there is the ability to actually run more buses. Most of our buses are stuck in gridlock, either because we have a traffic problem or because the mayor has not prioritized those buses. So I think, you know, we will always push the governor and, you know, under the governor, the MTA to do more, but the capital investments are so huge, right? It is the elevators, it is the signals, and it is finally having money lockboxed to do those things and to not just build a shiny, lovely station that then has no trains running reliably into it. And so this is part of finally building on that reliability and creating it so that we can do more things around it and get out of this self-fulfilling prophecy that we have where transit sucks and we have a subway that really does need to be fixed.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Carrie Fine. I'm a graduate student at NYU right now, and I've been doing some reporting on congestion pricing. One thing someone brought up to me was if the amount of cars is reduced, then presumably the amount you're making from congestion pricing is less, which seems like a kind of like weird dichotomy. So I was wondering how you would respond to that. If the amount of cars does go down, is there another plan for how the MTA could bring in money?
I mean, the traffic modeling and the revenue projection modeling assume a smaller number of cars that are entering than do now. So right now, the toll structure that we are adopting projects 17% fewer vehicles entering the CBD. If 20% fewer vehicles enter the CBD, that'll be great news for the environment, great news for the city. And, you know, this is a long program. So we have to, you know, the requirement is to raise $15 billion over, I don't know how long these bonds last, but 20, 30 years. So we can always adjust it over time.
And the $1 billion was... over
what time period? $1 billion is like a shorthand. Like we have to raise enough money to generate $15 billion, and in order to get $15 billion revenue in bonds, you roughly have to generate $1 billion a year in gross revenue.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi there. My name is Helena Salomon. I'm a science reporter with New York Amsterdam News. I'm wondering if the MTA or city DOT is monitoring health, environmental health impacts, things like replacing air monitors, kid asthma rates. Are those are they monitoring it to see if there's an impact due to a decrease with congestion pricing? And have they plotted out where those monitoring where that monitoring is being done?
That's a great question. So yes, and I don't know if you can speak to specifics. So they've added, so New York City has this amazing air monitoring system already in place. And the they are adding to that. It's New York City Department of Health and Mental Health, as well as some other city partners and state partners, I assume, DECs, putting some extra monitor just generally. So that is really important. And that is key to making sure these mitigation, that we have to know what's happening So we are also, I don't know that we have the specifics yet on where those locations are. We were just actually talking about that, that it would be great to know where they are and what the baseline is that, you know, that they're developing. Another thing, there's a project underway with NYU Langone that with the Regional Plan Association, and there's a community advisory board that is doing will be doing health impact studies related specifically to congestion pricing.
Can I ask a clarifying, just to make sure I understand right? So would the monitoring that we think about is taking place be relying on existing monitoring systems, or is the MTA or DOT looking at plotting out, like, based on congestion, or are they plotting out additional areas or their own?
My understanding is existing and additional ones specific to traffic and congestion pricing.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And they're already, all the new monitors are already collecting the data so that we have a pre-congestion pricing baseline.
Any other questions?
One more.
Let's go to other folks first, and then, sure.
My name is Matt Fleck. I'm a public resources field teacher. I'm wondering if you encountered any opposition from the auto industry or from the fossil fuel industry during this process, or if you expect any legal challenges from those industries moving forward.
No.
That's really true. You want to answer?
I have an editorializing point that I don't
think. No. And this is not exactly the question you're asking, but a lot of people ask how businesses, the business community, has expressed how they felt about this program. And by and large, they are very supportive, actually. Construction industry, or a lot of businesses that need that currently pay for their employees to be driving through the city and paying them, you know, by the hour, time wasted sitting in traffic. There was a study by the New York City Partnership a few years ago that estimated that the region loses $20 billion a year in lost productivity, people just sitting in traffic and paying for that.
Yeah.
Hi. I'm from the city council of Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was an earlier panelist. I was just wondering, like, I think a lot about how the gas tax will, like, you know, if everyone is successful, like, go down to zero because everyone's using EVs or something. And I was wondering how much you think of, like, this as being one of those ideas, at least for metro regions, might replace a gas tax or supplement it.
I'm sorry, I don't have a lot of thought as it relates to congestion pricing on that. I'll just say that, yes, as we transition to electric vehicles, certainly there has to be thought about losing the gas tax and how we replace that. Yeah.
Any other questions?
Go ahead. It's
related to, like, environmental health again, but wondering, you know, with the funds that required $15 billion to reach, has the MTA identified where they are going, some of the projects they already want to put funding towards, and how many of those are in EJ communities, communities that are already vulnerable and have had to deal with the ramifications of so much congestion in the city?
I'll take it.
Go ahead.
Yes, yes. And a couple of the biggest ticket items are extending the Second Avenue subway to East Harlem. Another big ticket item is at building four new Metro North stations in the Bronx on a line that already exists, but the trains currently zip right through. And a lot of other station renewal projects in EJ communities all around the city.
So that's sort of the general what's going to happen with this money. But as part of the mitigation measures, two bus depots that serve northern Manhattan and the Bronx, or either in the Bronx or northern Manhattan, but serve those communities, are being prioritized to be the first bus depots to be electrified. So,
which ones?
Gun Hill and, sorry, I don't want to take the time. I know I have it here. Oh, Kingsbridge. Kingsbridge and Gun Hill. Other things are, you know, greater greenery around highways that will provide, you know, and then in the Bronx specifically, some additional funds for asthma, education, prevention. So there's several mitigation measures that specifically address communities.
If there's time.
Yeah, go ahead.
Related to the EJ question, can we get a little bit of history as to why it was decided 60th Street and below? Why not the entirety of Manhattan or include the Bronx or include Brooklyn and Queens?
I think at one point, it was 96th Street. At one point, it was 96th Street. I think it really has to do with the numbers, right, of going into Manhattan and the congestion that exists in Manhattan. But to your point, there was someone that responded to something the other day I was reading, and or maybe it was a comment somewhere, and he said, yeah, this is great. And when are you going to do it for downtown Brooklyn? You know, so it could.
Well, and I think another piece of the history is going back to, was it Mayor Lindsay who wanted to toll the East River bridges? And so I think all of this is sort of morphed over many decades to then get the 2007 plan, which had the 96th Street. But it goes back to sort of understanding that a lot of people are going into Manhattan and they're already driving through communities in the outer boroughs to get there. And so how can we, that's like one of the things that I oftentimes think about as someone who lives in a community that gets driven through so that people can then go to a cheaper entrance into Manhattan. All of this is thinking about traffic patterns, the communities that people are already driving through, how we can reduce that. And then on top of that, after that is hopefully successful, do more for both the streets that have lesser traffic, but ideally create more policies. You know, you asked about a gas tax over here. We're thinking a lot about VMT bills in New York and how we can just pull more folks out of cars and put them into more sustainable, you know, multi-use types of transportation.
Yeah, go ahead.
So, Mary again. Under this plan, are residents given any different treatment? And then how about electric vehicles, e-bikes? Is there any consideration of those?
Well, low-income residents.
But, yeah. We heard from a lot of people who lived in the zone asking for an exemption. You know, on the one hand, they live in the zone. They have a right to a car. Many of them work outside the zone and drive there. It's about 600,000 people who live in the zone, so it wouldn't be a small exemption to provide. But the biggest thing is, you know, what would it say about the program that we would exempt people who happen to live in the most transit-rich part of the region, not people who need to commute into it with fewer options. So, no, but the low-income residents do get a special tax credit off of their New York State taxes.
I can just add, Environmental Defense Fund did some research a couple of years ago looking at whether a discount or an exemption for electric trucks would help incentivize electrification of trucks, because that's a market we really want to see get going. And our results showed that it might, but we made the decision not to keep pursuing that. As you can hear, it's so complex and any exemption or discount is just huge. But again, over time, as the program gets going, I like to think it might be possible to do things like that that would also result in greater benefits.
Are e-bikes considered bikes that don't have to pay?
If they don't have a license plate, there's no way to...
It'd be interesting to see that.
I think we have time for one more question, one or two more questions. Sure.
Hi, I'm Olivia Eager, and I'm also a grad student at NYU. I've done a lot of reporting on EMS and ambulances, and I just wanted to clarify a point that was kind of briefly touched on earlier. Can you just explain how ambulances will be affected? And my understanding is they're not in the total.
The ambulances are emergency vehicles. They are definitely exempt from the toll.
Okay.
Individuals who work in those jobs and have their own personal vehicles that are needed to drive to work are not exempt.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. That's what I got.
Okay. Last couple of questions.
Hi, Bridget Morris. Hey, I'm a freelance reporter. Kind of similar to that auto industry question earlier, I'm curious if parking garages downtown had anything to say about this. I'm sure they have any thoughts. Really? Check in the box. I guess why do you think that is? Because I think the auto industry, you know, yeah, I would have thought they would naturally have thoughts on people not wanting vehicles as much, perhaps, if, you know, kind of reducing that view.
I think some have actually, you know, it's not a monolith, right? But some have been supportive, right? And I think there is also a hope that, you know, A, we're not talking about such a dramatic decrease that parking garages will stop being necessary. It's very difficult to park on the street in this part of Manhattan, which is part of why when we talk about the economics of it, a lot of the people driving in are able to pay $70 to park in a parking garage, but then don't want to pay, you know, a fee to drive into the most congested part of the country, arguably. But let's say there was a parking garage that did have a decrease in cars parking in it. You know, there is a hope that in terms of like the ancillary policies that we might see, that maybe those parking garages could be used for different needs. You know, is there an opportunity to convert, you know, housing or greenery or whatever it might be? And so, you know, there are already conversations between advocates and the city agency that would oversee that about what more could be done. And we would hope that parking garage owners would really be excited to be a part of that conversation.
Last question?
Yep.
Hi, I'm Kia Wilson with State Blog USA. Could you all say a little bit more about how New York's experience navigating this might pave the way for other U.S. communities to implement congestion pricing programs, whether just simply at the level of securing federal approval, not being the first, or also like how you create a blueprint that can help other cities navigate the kinds of challenges we've discussed today?
Yes, again, I acknowledging that New York is unique. But again, the NEPA process is the NEPA process, and they, you know, they have been the first in the country to go through this for this particular policy. So I just think the learnings are incredible. Plus, I think the exemption piece, the whole thing with everybody just having gone through, I think that will be similar anywhere anybody proposes this. So I think all of it will be really helpful. I know a colleague of mine is really interested in developing a case study, right, with very specific learnings through the years, but certainly the last couple of years through the NEPA process.
Well, and I just would quickly add, I think, you know, from a campaigning perspective, 90% of a campaign happens after you win the campaign. Right. And I think we've seen that in all of the work that Juliet and the MTA has had to do, but that advocates have had to do. You know, we've been in a 5-year, like, so-called valley of death. And that type of learning, I think, is really, really important for advocates to, you know, stay faithful to a program. As, you know, when you're fighting for it, it's like, everything is possible, right? We're going to fix the subway, and then you win it. And it's like, well, we have like $1 billion and we can't fix everything. And so I think just that roadmap, and certainly we have been in a lot of conversation with transit advocates across the country who are really excited about the example that this will be able to set from an environmental, but, you know, putting that money into public and mass transit. And what can that mean, you know,
advocates at Move LA in Los Angeles or in Pittsburgh, you know, that really do need to see investment. They're excited and we're excited about that.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Round of applause for our panel.